Welcome to the world of Haruki Murakami.
This is the entrance, the brawny one says, and we're guarding it. And right now, the entrance happens to be open, the tall one explains. Before long, though, it'll close up. If you want to come in, now's the time. It doesn't open up all that often.
I opened the door, and standing there, 2 yards away, was the sheep man, showing markedly little interest in either the open door or myself who opened it, carefully inspecting the mailbox as if it were a rare, exotic specimen.
I remember with perfect clarity that first night I lost the ability to sleep. I was having a repulsive dream, a dark, slimy dream.
I search for lost cats. I can speak to cats a little, so I go all over the place, tracking down ones that have gone missing.
That was when her face began to change. A fleshy white thing crept out of one nostril. It was a maggot, an enormous maggot, larger than any I had ever seen before.
Memory is like fiction, or else it's fiction that's like memory.
Philosophical, surreal, extraordinary, dreamlike, yet rooted in a language and style that is natural and contemporary, Haruki Murakami has created works that resonate with readers around the world, despite their frequent branches into the fabulous. Hello, I'm Roy McMillan, the producer of several of Murakami's books for Naxos. Consequently, I've found myself in his world quite a lot. He creates a portrait of 21st century uncertainty and consumerism, standing unapologetically alongside or interrupted by a fantastic other world. In Kafka on the Shore, to name just one example, there are soldiers unaged since the war, guarding an entrance to an alternative world of disquieting acquiescence, and ectoplasmic apparitions with violent intentions, quite apart from literal elements of the Oedipal myth, epicene haemophiliacs, and the shadows of those who have glimpsed beyond the natural world. I mean, it's quite a long novel, but even so. As Murakami says himself, he writes weird stories. In Kafka on the Shore, a truck driver is approached by an insensate being in the form of KFC's Colonel Sanders, who acts as a fast-talking pimp, introducing the driver to a Hegel-quoting whore before leading him to an object whose significance is recognised but not understood. On the way, Colonel Sanders tries to explain a little more about himself.
As I've explained, I don't have any form. I'm a metaphysical, conceptual object. I can take on any form, but I lack substance. And to perform a real act, I need someone with substance to help out. And at this particular point, that substance happens to be me. Exactly, Colonel Sanders replied. They cautiously continued down the path and came to a smaller shrine beneath a thick oak tree. The shrine was old and dilapidated, with no offerings or decorations of any kind. Colonel Sanders shined his torch on it. The stone's inside there. Open the door.
No way, Hoshino replied. You're not supposed to open up shrines whenever you feel like it. You'll be cursed. Your nose will fall off, or your ears or something.
Not to worry. I said it's all right, so go ahead and open it. You won't be cursed. Your nose and ears won't fall off. God, you can be really old-fashioned.
Then why don't you open it? I don't want to get mixed up in that.
How many times do I have to explain this? I told you already I don't have substance. I'm an abstract concept. I can't do anything on my own. That's why I went to the trouble of dragging you out here and letting you do it 3 times at a discount rate.
Yeah, man, she was fantastic. But robbing a shrine? No way. My grandfather always told me not to mess with shrines. He was really strict about it.
Forget about your grandfather. Don't lay all your Gifu Prefecture country bumpkin morality on me, okay? We don't have time for that.
Grumbling all the while, Hoshino hesitantly opened the door of the shrine, and Colonel Sanders shone his torch inside. Sure enough, there was an old round stone inside. Just like Nakata said, it was about the size of a big rice cake, a smooth white stone.
This is it? Hoshino asked. That's right, Colonel Sanders said. Take it out.
Hold on a minute. That's stealing.
No matter. Nobody's going to notice if a stone like this is missing, and nobody'll care.
Yeah, but the stone is owned by God, right? He's going to be pissed off if we take it out.
Colonel Sanders folded his arms and stared straight at Hoshino.
What is God?
Murakami was born in 1949 and spent most of his childhood in Kobe, with parents who were teachers and followers of the traditional Japanese literary world. Early in his life, he decided that this ancient formalism did not suit him, and a series of minor rebellions, marrying young, rejecting the salaryman lifestyle expected of him, opening a jazz cafe, singled him out from many of his contemporaries. His love of European literature and American music meant that when he decided to become a writer, what he wrote would instinctively have an appeal beyond his own country. The decision to dedicate himself to writing happened in a manner that could have come from one of his own stories. A jazz-mad Japanese baseball fan, that's Murakami, sees a celebrated player hit a double and hears a voice telling him to write a novel. So he does. And over the next decade, he became so popular in Japan that he had to leave it, a physical manifestation of a spiritual sense of dislocation. He toured widely and taught in two American universities before returning to Japan after the Kobe earthquake, which destroyed his parents' house, and the gas attacks on the Tokyo Underground. Now settled in a suburb of the capital, he lives a life where physical fitness, good food, cats, and in particular music, are the principal activities outside his writing. And all of them feature in his fiction, too. Music is threaded through his work with the deliberate insistence of a Tarantino soundtrack, signifying, reflecting, or setting into relief the characters or their environments. As in the short story, The Second Bakery Attack, from the collection The Elephant Vanishes.
The baker was a classical music freak, and when we got there, he was listening to an album of Wagner overtures. So he made us a deal. If we would listen to the record all the way through, we could take as much bread as we liked. I talked it over with my buddy, and we figured, okay, it wouldn't be work in the purest sense of the word, and it wouldn't hurt anybody. So we put our knives back in our bag, pulled up a couple of chairs, and listened to the overtures to Tannhäuser and the Flying Dutchman.
And after that, you got your bread?
Right. Most of what he had in the shop. Stuffed it in our bag and took it home. Kept us fed for maybe 4 or 5 days. I took another sip. Like soundless waves from an undersea earthquake, my sleepiness gave my boat a long, slow rocking. Of course, we accomplished our mission. We got the bread. But you couldn't say we had committed a crime. It was more of an exchange. We listened to Wagner with him, and in return, we got our bread. Legally speaking, it was more like a commercial transaction.
But listening to Wagner is not work, she said.
Oh, no, absolutely not. If the baker had insisted that we wash his dishes or clean his windows or something, we would have turned him down. But he didn't. All he wanted from us was to listen to his Wagner LP from beginning to end. Nobody could have anticipated that. I mean, Wagner?
It was like the baker put a curse on us. Now that I think of it, we should have refused. We should have threatened him with our knives and taken the damn bread. Then there wouldn't have been any problem. You had a problem?
I rubbed my eyes again. Sort of. Nothing you could put your finger on, but things started to change after that. It was kind of a turning point, like I went back to the university and I graduated and I started working for the firm and studying for the bar exam and I met you and got married. I never did anything like that again. No more bakery attacks.
That's it?
Yep, that's all there was to it. I drank the last of the beer. Now all 6 cans were gone. 6 pull tabs lay in the ashtray like scales from a mermaid.
Murakami's popularity is in part due to his accessibility. His work seems airily light, laconic, funny, deceptively simple and, somehow paradoxically, leavened with sequences of explicit and extreme violence or sexual content. This lightness or dreaminess is also reflected in the plots. They can begin with a single line that occurs to Murakami and which he then expands entirely at his imaginative whim, allowing himself to be taken on the journey as much as the reader and accepting each new development as it occurs without questioning it. As a result, the world he creates has the same relationship to the real world as believable dreams do, and there is the same unpredictability and convincing absurdity as there is in dreams, the same apparent yet frequently unrevealed significance about objects. In allowing his waking imagination the same freedoms as our dream worlds, Murakami has tapped into an unconscious that resonates with readers from Tokyo to San Francisco, even if they are unsure how his stories seem to relate to their own. In A Wild Sheep Chase, the first-person narrator, a very typical Murakami style, is in a vaguely creative job that doesn't much interest him, again, a common theme in his work, and it's easy enough to see the relevance to 20th-century Western man. But then the character becomes involved in a hunt for a power-crazed sheep.
"By all means, I would like to meet your father," I said.
"I have no objection to your meeting him, but since my father dislikes me, you'll have to excuse me if I ask you to go alone,"
said the son of the sheep professor. "Dislikes you?"
"Because I lost 2 fingers and I'm balding."
"I see," I said. "An eccentric man, your father."
"As his son, it's not for me to say, but yes, an eccentric man indeed. A completely changed man since he encountered sheep. Extremely difficult, sometimes even cruel. Deep down in his heart, he's kind. If you heard him play his violin, you'd know that. Sheep hurt my father, and through my father, sheep have also hurt me."
"You love your father, don't you?"
said my girlfriend.
"Yes, that I do. I love him very much,"
said the Dolphin Hotel owner.
"But he dislikes me. He never once held me since the day I was born. Never once had a kind word for me. And since I lost my fingers and started going bald, he's done nothing but ridicule me."
"I'm sure he doesn't mean to ridicule you," she said.
"I can't believe that he would either," I said.
"You're too kind,"
said the hotel man. "Should we go and try to see him directly then?" I asked.
"I don't know," said the hotel man. "Though I'm sure he'll see you if you're careful about 2 things. One is to state clearly that you wish to inquire about sheep."
"And the other?"
"Don't say that I told you about him."
"Fair enough," I said. We thanked the sheep professor's son and headed up the stairs. The air at the top of the stairs was chilly and damp. The lights were dim, scarcely revealing the dust drifts in the corners of the hallway. The whole place smelled indistinctly of old papers and old body odors. We walked down the long hallway as per the son's instructions and knocked on the ancient door at the end. An old plastic plaque affixed to the door read, "Director's Office." No answer. I knocked again. Again no answer. At the third knock, there was a groan, and then the response.
"Don't bother me. Go away."
"We've come to ask a few things about sheep, if we might."
"Eat shit!"
yelled the sheep professor from inside, a mighty, healthy voice for 73.
"We really have to talk with you," I shouted through the door.
"Don't give me this, you want to talk about sheep crap,"
said the sheep professor.
"But it's something that probably ought to be discussed," I coaxed. "It's about a sheep that disappeared in 1936.
There was a brief silence. Then the door flew open. Before us stood the sheep professor.
At which point, clearly, any immediate connection to a sense of contemporary ennui or art as a reflection of life becomes a little less obvious. It's not that he avoids contentious issues. He frequently alludes to aspects of Japan's imperial past, for example, and its near censorship in current Japanese thinking. It's simply that in Murakami's magical, uncertain worlds, even the familiar is imbued with the supernatural or surreal.
"My husband left for work as usual, and I couldn't think of anything to do. I sat alone in the chair by the window, staring out at the garden through the gap between the curtains. Not that I had any reason to be looking at the garden. There was nothing else for me to do. And I thought that sooner or later, if I sat there looking, I might think of something. Of all the many things in the garden, the one I looked at most was the oak tree. It was my special favorite. I had planted it when I was a little girl and watched it grow. I thought of it as my old friend. I talked to it all the time in my head. That day, too, I was probably talking to the oak tree. I don't remember what about. and I don't know how long I was sitting there. The time slips by when I'm looking at the garden. It was dark before I knew it. I must have been there quite a while. Then all at once, I heard a sound. It came from somewhere far away, a funny, muffled sort of rubbin' sort of sound. At first I thought it was coming from a place deep inside me, that I was hearing things, a warning from the dark cocoon my body was spinning within. I held my breath and listened. Yes, no doubt about it. Little by little the sound was moving closer to me. What was it? I had no idea. But it made my flesh creep. The ground near the base of the tree began to bulge upward, as if some thick, heavy liquid were rising to the surface. Again I caught my breath. Then the ground broke open, and the mounded earth crumbled away to reveal a set of sharp claws. My eyes locked onto them, and my hands turned into clenched fists. Something's gonna happen, I said to myself. It started now. The claws scraped hard at the soil, and soon the break in the earth was an open hole, from which there crawled a little green monster. Its body was covered with shining green scales. As soon as it emerged from the hole, it shook itself until the bits of soil clinging to it dropped away. It had a long, funny nose, the green of which gradually deepened toward the tip. The very end was narrow and pointed as a whip, but the beast's eyes were exactly like a human's. The sight of them sent a shiver through me. They showed feelings, just like your eyes or mine.
But what does this little green monster in the eponymous short story from the Elephant Vanishes collection actually mean? Is he allegorical, symbolic, actual? With Murakami, there are rarely any simple answers, no easy completeness or neatly rounded endings, no sense that the world does, in fact, make sense, and no reassuringly satisfactory resolution. This moral ambivalence may be at the heart of his appeal. His stories are disturbing and relevant to people all over the world. Although set nominally in Japan, there is very little that is exclusively Japanese in them, and the frequency with which American and European brands, musicians, authors and thinkers are mentioned gives his work a kind of geographical universality. This has a specific effect in Japan, where there is still discussion about the way that the country has absorbed so much of Western culture and what this has done to the country's collective psyche. But Murakami's strength is to place these extraordinary tales not at the heart of national inquiry, but at the point where the conscious and the unconscious sense of self make contact.
I close my eyes and relax, letting my tense muscles go loose. I listen to the steady hum of the train. And then, without warning, a warm tear spills from my eye, runs down my cheek to my mouth, and after a while, dries up. No matter, I tell myself. It's just one tear. It doesn't even feel like it's mine. More like part of the rain outside. Did I do the right thing? You did the right thing, the boy named Crow says. You did what was best. No one else could have done as well as you did. After all, you're the genuine article. The toughest 15-year-old in the world. But I still don't know anything about life, I protest. Look at the painting, he says. And listen to the wind. I nod. I know you can do it. I nod again. You'd better get some sleep, the boy named Crow says. When you wake up, you'll be part of a brand new world. Eventually you fall asleep. And when you wake up, it's true. You are part of a brand new world.
The world of Haruki Murakami. And to hear his world brought to life in audiobook form, go to any good bookshop or log on to www.naxosaudiobooks.com.